HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 389, recorded live Thursday, September 12th, 2013. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, makers of GesturePack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with consultant Linda Rising about the Agile mindset.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. On the phone, I've got Linda Rising, a consultant who does a lot of work in the Agile space. And thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's always a pleasure to watch you present. I've had the pleasure of actually meeting you, I think, on all the continents that were not the U.S. continent. I've never met you in North America, but I've seen you around the world. You do a lot of presentations that I think challenge people's way of thinking. I do a lot of presentations on code, and you do a lot of presentations on psychology and mindset.
And I guess I should apologize for that because I'm not an expert in psychology. My PhD is in computer science, and I think for most of my life, I would have to say I've been a technical person. So the discovery that there are other dimensions to software came late in life for me, and I feel like I'm playing the role of Marley in the Christmas Carol. Do you remember seeing that at Christmas or reading that book by Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol? Yes, because Marley is dead and his ghost visits Scrooge and he says, "Scrooge, Scrooge, I don't want you to make the same mistakes I did. I'm trying to save you from the fate I have." And he rattles his chains and Scrooge becomes very fearful. And so I'm not dead yet, but I feel like that's my role. I don't want other technical people to make the same mistakes I did, just to believe that it's all technical, that if we just had a better programming language or a better environment, better tools, that somehow all those problems that we have would go away.
I think that people who are excited about building and excited about software think that all those problems can be solved by their tools. And I'll see people put Agile into a system and it ends up being what I like to call Scrummerfall. They'll just take Waterfall and just patch Scrum onto it. And it's just an excuse to be sloppy. But they focus so much on the tools, they forget that these are humans that are building software.
And I think that Agile has brought that to the table, and perhaps it's a combination, at least for me personally, of Agile and, of course, patterns, since I'm a patterns junkie, that really changed my way of thinking, and it made it possible for me to leave behind that very strict, very technical bias and to look around me for the first time and to see that, indeed, these are people. Indeed, we have trouble communicating. Indeed, we don't always understand each other as well as we should when we try to talk about even technical topics. And that there's an enormous amount of research in the areas of cognitive neuroscience and psychology that speaks directly to what we are doing. We should pay attention.
What should I do or a listener do as a developer to avoid reading all of these books on psychology, but at the same time be not so ignorant on these things? You know, do I just be aware that there are different ways of thinking about this, or do I just watch a Linda Rising presentation?
I think that awareness is the first step, and I know that for me, that was the beginning, that just being aware that there are other things besides all of the technical issues on the table. And now it's not just me, but there are others who are trying, and it's not an easy task, trying to keep up with all the advances in neuroscience and to do a pretty good job of translating what those neuroscientists are learning about our brains and to tell everybody in the software arena, here are some very useful things that will help us do our jobs better. So it's not just me, but there are many of us messenger translators who are trying to do a good job of keeping up, who subscribe to all the podcasts and read all the journals and try to skim the books looking for little nuggets, and that if people are just aware that those possibilities are out there and to do what they can to pay attention. There's so much that it's impossible to keep up with it.
Well, certainly it's impossible if you're also trying to keep up on the latest tool and the latest widget. It's pretty overwhelming.
That is the problem that we all face. I have a little training class that I give on thinking and influence strategies, and I point out that the last person to know everything was John Stuart Mill, who died in the late 1800s. And he was able to know everything because there wasn't that much to know. He could be a philosopher and a scientist and a theologian and economist and truly know all there was to know about all those fields, whereas now we can't know anything. The ability to keep up in any small, narrow field is impossible. So therefore, it's really impossible to look outside your field to bring in information from neuroscience or psychology or history. We should be looking at history, art, music. We can't do it.
But at the same time, there is the ability to grow. And you bring up in an email as we were planning this talk, the work by Carol Dweck, who has a book called Mindset about the new psychology of success. And the premise of Mindset is this idea that people either have a sense that they can grow and that their talents can be expanded, or they have a fixed mindset where they're born with that amount of talent. They get their attributes when they're born and they cannot get any more information. They cannot become better than they were born.
Yes. And I think for me, the work of Carol Dweck was an eye-opener. And again, I felt that I had to apologize for myself because I wasn't aware of it. And I felt that I myself had a little bit of a fixed mindset in certain areas. So when I discovered that research, I thought perhaps it would be as eye-opening for other technical people to realize that our fixed mindsets might be holding us back. So I put together a little talk, and I gave it for the first time as a keynote at the end of Agile 2011. And that talk should be still out there. I think if people just Google on Linda Rising, Agile Mindset, Agile 2011, there's something on YouTube or something on the Agile site, and so everybody could hear that talk. And it was astounding to me, the reception that I got, because most people were as overwhelmed with that information as I had been, and as surprised at their own mindsets, and as amazed at the effect that a particular mindset might have on their teams, on their families, on the lives of their friends, on their children. I get enormous amounts of emails still about that talk. And of course, I've given other variations on it since. So I think it's probably one of the most important things I've ever talked about or maybe even thought about.
Wow. I will definitely add a link to that to the show notes so people who are listening can just go to the website, and the link to the Agile Mindset talk will be right there. One of the things that I have personally thought about a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset is that there's kind of a working theory that people who know that they are talented have a tendency to believe that that is an inborn thing and other people cannot achieve, while people who may have come up in less than ideal circumstances, or people who have kind of literally pulled themselves up through their own bootstrap. Maybe they went to community college and became a developer as opposed to going to a a privileged school might believe that a growth mindset is simply how the world works.
Yeah, I think we all do that to a certain extent, and I know I challenge myself all the time when I sort of go down that path to believe that there is ability or natural talent that people just have, that they were born with it, that they're a Tiger Woods or a Beethoven or an Einstein. And certainly the research that Carol Dweck has done does not say that we can all reach incredible heights of accomplishment in any area we choose. What the research shows is that no matter where we are today, we can all get better. And just having that attitude, that mindset toward whatever it is that we're trying to do means a lot of things about how we are as people. It means that we look at ourselves as growing, that we look at ourselves as learning, improving over time. And a magic thing happens as soon as we look at ourselves that way, we also begin to look at other people that way. So we're less likely to stereotype, to judge, to work better with others on our team, because we are constantly in the business 24/7 of evaluating everybody around us, saying, well, you have it, obviously, or she does not have it. And that gets in the way of our team behavior, our communication, the kinds of products we produce. There are classic examples of how managers do this. Managers very quickly, even before they know the performance abilities of people they hire, have already made up their minds about who's going to be a stellar performer and who is not. And that attitude by managers affects the behavior of those people. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the power that managers, and not only managers, but that we all have over the performance of other people is enormous. So this belief that we are all growing, we're all learning, we can all get better. Maybe we won't be Beethoven or Einstein, but that we can be better tomorrow than we are today is enormously influential.
When I was growing up, they used to call these tapes, or at least maybe my mom used to call them tapes. And she used to say, you have these tapes running in your head that's telling you whether or not you're good at something or not. And you have the choice to change those tapes and as such change how you look at the world and how the world will then treat you.
I think that's probably a good metaphor, because we do have a little voice in our head. It's the conscious mind that starts talking to us as soon as we wake up. And it may be a combination of things we heard from our own parents or an influential teacher or someone we respected who told us something about ourselves. And we play that tape and we listen to that voice and we believe it. And when we get discouraged, and we're always going to get discouraged, we reach some challenge and that tape starts running and it says, see, you don't have it. You're not very good at whatever this thing is. You'll probably never be very good. And immediately we begin to believe that. And immediately it becomes true. So we need to analyze those tapes, and awareness helps. And we should keep going back to that, because the research is pretty clear that just informing people that there are the two mindsets, the belief in growth, or the belief in fixed talent, but just awareness can help us maybe make some adjustments in that tape, maybe listen to some other voices, maybe steer our efforts in a better direction. And once we can do that for ourselves, we can see that in others or in our children, and we can help them as well.
You talk in your presentation on the Agile mindset, and you reference some examples where they did actual experiments. And a lot of people think that, some people, and particularly engineers, think that psychology is just a bunch of nonsense. And, you know, we're all just kind of talking ourselves in circles here. But this is real science. There is neuroscience behind this, and behaviors change when mindsets change. And you give this example where they categorized people, students, into different groups, saying that this is a really smart, inherently smart group of people, and these are the kids that put effort into their work. And how did their behavior change when the mindset and the context for the tests was changed?
There's not only a research around all of this mindset, but the research has been going on for decades. One of the things that psychologists do is not only experiment, but they repeat experiments. It has to be something that researchers have uncovered and also shared with others, and then have those others repeat so they validate the results. I often get on a little bit of a soapbox about people who are in software development saying that we are not scientific. Most of us who have come to the agile process have done so simply by hearing good stories. We've been overwhelmed by a good story that someone else told us about a team that had tremendous success as soon as they became an adopter of Scrum or XP, but we never looked at hard data. We never saw any kind of balanced, controlled, randomized, scientific experiment in order to make a decision. We're swayed all the time by evidence that really wouldn't stand up in any scientific arena. So when you look at everything that's been done around mindset, the amount of research there is overwhelming. It's been done with children. It's been done with adults. It's been done with sports teams. It's been done in business. And what it shows is that with a very, very small kind of difference in mindset, you get very different behaviors. People who have been encouraged to adopt the fixed mindset, for instance, immediately change all their goals so that they look good. They immediately look at failure as a way of defining themselves instead of taking it as a challenge. When anything goes wrong for those children or people who are on the sports team and they look at failure, they immediately give up. They become helpless and hopeless. Whereas in the experimental data, it's pretty clear that those that have been moved into an agile mindset suddenly embrace goals that are about learning. They take on challenges. They get excited about hard things where they might not appear to be successful, but where they might learn. And in the face of failure, they become resilient. They become someone who, and this for me was the connection with agile software development, they embrace failure. They don't take it as a label or as a sign that they don't have it. They say, this is an opportunity for me to learn. The differences are so clear. And what's done to nudge those groups is usually just a very small thing. As you said, to simply say to someone, oh, you did really well here, you must be very smart. Or to the other group, oh, you did really well here, you must have worked hard. And that those two slightly different statements are enough to encourage a different mindset, a different goal setting, a different way of looking at failure. The results, based on those little tiny nudges, are astounding.
Yesterday, I was reading to my 5-year-old and my 7-year-old, and the 7-year-old has started reading just in the last, a couple of months. We say that he's got his superpower. Basically, he woke up one day and he could read, and it's one of those things that happens when kids are growing up. They click, and reading clicked a little while ago for him. The 5-year-old, on the other hand, is exactly 2 years younger, almost to the day. And they were reading, and the 7-year-old's having a blast, and the 5-year-old's really struggling. And I encouraged the 5-year-old to read a word, and he struggled with it. And the 7-year-old, without being malicious, said, oh, that's okay. He's not very smart at this. And I just saw the 5-year-old just kind of wince and then almost fall over with, you could see him kind of wilting. And it wasn't malicious. It was just two little boys that I think that they are twins. You know, they think of each other as peers. And the 7-year-old truly doesn't understand that the 5-year-old is 2 full years behind him, which is effectively a third of his entire life.
Yes. Yeah.
And I worry about that. In my mind as parent, I'm thinking, okay, and then it's going to be 30 and 32. And the 30-year-old is going to think that he's not, I'm no good. I'm not smart enough. How do we prevent these little missteps from kind of setting the direction for the entire life?
Well, one of the things you can do is make the analogy with strength, that probably the older one is also stronger, can lift or move things, and that you should point out that, well, you can move this heavy object or you can pick up this heavy object. Yes, you're stronger than your brother because you're older. He's still growing. The older one is also probably taller.
Yeah.
And to say, well, you're taller than your brother because you're older and he's still growing. He'll become taller. He'll become stronger. He'll become better. And that the idea that all of those abilities are exactly the same. So the ability to read, the ability to solve problems, to understand, to speak language, all of those mental things are exactly like all those physical things, that most of the time even children can understand the difference between somebody who is older, who is taller, who is stronger. And if they understand that all of those things that have to do with thinking or learning or reading or speaking are exactly the same, because they are, that helps them understand that it's not that the other person is dumber or stupider. They're just younger and they're still growing. And that they, when they compare themselves to someone who's older than they are, should also not be discouraged that, well, they're still growing. They're getting better. They're getting taller. They're getting stronger. They're learning more. And that's the lesson that we want as parents or grandparents to tell our children or grandchildren, is that continues beyond childhood, when you're out of school, when you're older, that you never lose that attitude of growing and learning, and that the research is clear. Your brain continues to develop new pathways, new capabilities until you die.
So it would be a totally reasonable thing for me to, in the face of failure, to tell my boss I'm still growing.
Of course. As long as your boss supported that attitude. And you know, the research is also clear on organizations, that there are organizations that have a fixed mindset.
So what would happen to growth people in a situation like that?
They hire for talent, and there's a continual pressure on the people in the organization to show that they have it. Steve Jobs is famous for talking to the people who were on the Apple Lisa team, and he said, you guys don't have it. You're B players.
Ouch.
We don't have B players around here. We only have A players. I think maybe you guys need to find jobs elsewhere. He was brutal. He did a very good job of labeling people and calling them less than stellar if anything went wrong. And of course, we know many times the success of your project doesn't necessarily depend on the ability of the people in it. It's probably much more complicated than that. But he was a very good example of somebody who had a fixed mindset and who ran an organization that had a fixed. So the organization itself has that mindset. And if it does, it encourages behavior in the people who are in it that's exactly like the behavior of people who have a fixed mindset. They want to look good. In order to do that, they might cheat. They might sabotage the work of others. They'll do a lot of underhanded things so that they will look better and they'll get the promotion or the recognition, or someone will call them an A player. So there's a lot of labeling, a lot of negative behavior that results in organizations where the people in it and the organization itself, if you can think of an organizational mind, are very fixed. It's so different from organizations that have an agile mindset, where it's about learning, it's about growing, that mistakes are when you learn something important and you should take advantage of that. My example is Southwest Airlines. They hire people for attitude. Can you learn? Are you excited about learning? Are you willing to try new things? Do you do out-of-the-box thinking? And they encourage that. And the people who work there, I've never worked at Southwest, but the people I know who do say it's exactly like that. It's a challenging organization where everybody is encouraged to keep on growing, to keep on learning. And that's where we all want to be.
Mm. Interesting. That's really powerful. I mean, I think it's a constant struggle as we have those tapes saying, I can't and I won't, or I won't be able to. And then if that gets supported by an organization, like one of the things that we struggle with sometimes at Microsoft where I work is they have this program called the Stack Ranking. And I've seen this at Intel and other large companies where we got to line everybody up by height, effectively, where height is ability. And if you get a label where you are, you know, underachieved,
yeah,
then that's it. Well, yeah, at other organizations, they may give you a moment in time. They may measure a moment in time and say, well, you know, you were a 3 this period. They also will simultaneously have a potential number and indicate when ranking you and trying to give you your bonus at the end of the year that, you know, but you're showing great potential, or your effort is recognized, or, you know, most improved and things like that. What do you think when it comes time to find out if the team is an effective team and someone is not performing well, how do you rank that?
Well, you know, not everybody is working up to their full potential all the time. And there can be many reasons for that. And if it's going to be an effective organization, it has to provide opportunities for everyone up to a certain point. And I think sometimes it's that people are not happy in what they're doing. And if people are not happy, then they should try something else. But it shouldn't be about your capabilities, period. It's that for some reason, You're not happy here and you're not doing as well as whatever the standard is that we need for this organization. And maybe we can find another place for you. But that shouldn't happen, that severing of ties, without some effort on the part of the organization, in my belief, to see what can be done. Perhaps it's the result of many sorts of things. I don't think this is a clear-cut thing, mm-hmm. but what the research shows pretty clearly is that there are a lot of people who are labeled early in their lives who mm-hmm. don't do well. All the research now that Carol Dweck and her graduate students are doing is around minority students and women. Why aren't there more women in IT? And what it shows pretty clearly is that at some point, they have taken on this fixed mindset that, well, I can't do it. That girls believe at a pretty young age that they can't do math or science. It's also true for Hispanics and Blacks, that when they learn that the mind is a muscle and when they're moved toward the agile mindset, they all do better. But up until that point, they're so weighed down by things they've been told all their lives that they don't perform well. They don't do well in math or science. And in fact, Hispanics and Blacks typically underperform across the board. And all of the experiments that Dweck's research has shown is that just with some small interventions, they all begin to make enormous improvements. What are we doing? What are we doing to little children? What are we doing to people in organizations by this early labeling, by throwing them into this fixed mindset? We're losing enormous amounts of contributions, innovation, ideas, because we believe they can't do it, and therefore they believe they can't do it, and they can't.
It's amazing how one sentence will make that difference. I remember growing up in the 70s that there was a Barbie doll that came out with a string, and you'd pull the string on her back, and she would say, "Math is hard."
I think I missed that. That's good, though.
And it was an outrage because that one sentence. Who knows the damage that was done with that one sentence? But I've heard in these research experiments when giving people a test, just as you're passing out the papers, if you say something like, you know, women tend to do better on this test, they will do better.
Or
even if it's not true, they just simply by saying that, it sets the mindset, it sets the tone for the entire test.
Yes. There's also a variation that's been done on that at the top when the participant fills in information, name, address, social security number. If there's a little box where they have to check male or female.
Mm-hmm.
On some versions of the test, they check female. On other versions, they don't check female, but otherwise the test is exactly the same. And in a balanced controlled experiments, just checking that little box can cause a significant decrease in the score. Even when afterwards the participants are asked, did you notice there was a little box where you had to check female? And most don't even remember it. But clearly, it had a powerful effect on how they did on that exam. It started the little tape that said, oh, yes, I guess I am female. Oh, yes, everybody knows that females don't do as well. We all know that. We buy into our own stereotypes. So even women believe themselves that they're not as good, and therefore they're not.
And we have to build up that resiliency. So as those little tapes are running, both, you know, cultural, contextual, team, organizational are running, as we bump into those messages, we have to be resilient against them.
Yes. And we have to have our own messages. We have to have our own messages about failure is good. We have to have our own messages about learning is good. This is an opportunity for me to learn. And we have to mentor others instead of telling people, oh, you're great, you're wonderful, or saying that to our children, to say, oh, you really worked hard, I like the way you, and praise what was done, praise the strategy, point out the process, instead of labeling, instead of putting people in boxes, instead of encouraging that fixed mindset. We need to do a better job, just not only for our own families, but for our own little tapes, and for the tapes of other people that we care about.
Some people have said that that's a uniquely American problem, that there was a time in the 80s and 90s where every child was told that they were special, and not everyone can be, quote-unquote, special. So if you tell
that's
every
right.
child that they are a unique snowflake, you end up with a lot of children that grow up into 20-year-olds who believe that they are a unique snowflake, and they come out of college saying, where's my $100,000 a year job?
Indeed. Although I have given this talk in China, and I ask along the way of the participants, do you know what I'm talking about? And of course, in China, Mao's one child policy has been in effect now for over 30 years. And when you walk around in Tiananmen Square on a Sunday, and you see the little children there who are all dressed up in their costumes, even little girls now, I'm happy to say. And the expression in Chinese is every child has six parents. So there are the parents who only have one child, of course, and they are the product of a family where there was only one child. So here are the two sets of grandparents. So here are six adults hovering around this one child who's given all the attention, all the focus, all the expectation of the whole family. And they're told from the very beginning, oh, you're the best. You're the smartest. You have to work hard. The family depends upon you. Enormous pressure on these little tiny children from the get-go. So what's coming out are, I don't know how to say it in Chinese, but they're called little emperors or little empresses who are just as fixed, just as entitled as any of the American children who had been told the same from the time they were born. You are special. You get the blue ribbon. You're number one. You should get straight A's. And in many classes, that's the case now. Parents put pressure on teachers. My child deserves an A. Can't you see that my child is the best? I even heard from a manager just recently who got a call from the mother of one of his new hires who wanted to know why he wasn't being promoted. Why wasn't he getting bonuses? Why wasn't he on the fast track? Didn't this manager know how brilliant her son was?
Wow. Yeah. I really, really hope that that never happens to me.
Indeed.
Well, thank you so much, Linda Rising, for chatting with me today.
It's been my pleasure, Scott. Thank you for inviting me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.